It's the 7th of June, 2015, at the Aviva Stadium in Dublin. The Republic of Ireland are playing England in a friendly. With the crowds gathered, an old man, with the help of an aide, comes from the tunnel. The guest of honour. Jack Charlton looked frailer now. As he gets to the edge of the pitch, a huge applause put him under pressure, blasting out across the stadium loudspeakers. People with grey hair starting to show, thinking of all the memories they'd seen. The nights that were spent watching his teams. People younger wishing they'd been around to grasp the enormity of what was done. And kids now going to games with their grandparents, wondering if it was all truly real. Hero turns to legend and legend to myth. That is the passage of time. Looking emotional, but still with the same old glinting smile, he waved to the crowd. Perhaps still surprised at the love and affection with which he was still held, that people never forgot. But on the 13th of December, 1996 at Anfield, Jack waved to Ireland fans again. This time, however, it was goodbye. The end of an era, a decade that took Irish football to the centre of the world stage. We had dreamed of just getting to major tournaments before, but under Jack, we dreamed about winning them. With flat cap firmly on head, Jack turned and walked down the tunnel one last time. The hero, the legend, the myth was gone, and we'd never see the likes again. Hello and welcome to this week's Green Shoots, a history of Irish football. Coming up, me and Gary are talking about the end of an era as Jack Charlton steps away from the Republic of Ireland after 10 years that delivered so many memories. It came at the end of the Euro 96 qualifiers as Ireland missed out on a journey to England. Don't forget to share the show on your social media channels to let more people find out about the history and heritage of Irish football. Turn on notifications on whatever podcast platform you use so that you can get notified straight away when a new episode drops. Now, in 1996, Jack Charlton walked down the tunnel at Anfield. It would be the very last time he walked off the pitch as manager of the Republic of Ireland after a 2-0 loss in a Euro playoff to the Netherlands. It was the end of a campaign that offered so much promise at the start, but saw us fall short at the last hurdle. It was the end of an era too, as Jack Charlton stepped down as Ireland manager. So lots to talk about, including an infamous night at Lansdowne Road as England fans get the match abandoned with Ireland leading 1-0. So let's get down to it. So I suppose, Gary, if we start off this week, we're going to talk about the qualifying for Euro 96. I suppose we're coming straight off the back of USA 94, and the Republic of Ireland team were straight into those Euro qualifiers. But I suppose maybe talk to us a little bit about where is this team right now in this kind of period, because we've lost, we're out of the World Cup to Netherlands. 2 months later, we're into the Euro qualifiers. So is there much time to kind of, I suppose, process the things that maybe went wrong in the World Cup and move them forward for Euro 96, or where are you with this team?
I suppose, I mean, we had gone in, we'd been to three of the last four major tournaments at this stage, and we had done pretty well. I mean, we were one of the top teams in the world at the time. We were top seeds for the draw for Euro 96. So we would have been expected to qualify. Another thing that happened between Euro 92 and 96 was the tournament doubled in size from 8 teams to 16. So we were top seeds. There were 8 groups. The 8 group winners qualified, and the 6 runners up also qualified. 6 best runners up, with the last 2 runners up playing off for the 15th place, with England as hosts, obviously. So we would have been very optimistic about qualifying. even though we'd lost to the Dutch, which we talked about the last time, was a very disappointing defeat. We were expected to bounce back. Jack was still involved. Paddy Bonner retired, but Alan Kelly was a more than able deputy in goal. This was really his campaign because Shea Given hadn't come on the scene yet. So it was thought we were in reasonably good shape. There might have been some concerns. Maybe these happened as you went on into the campaign about a changing of the guard. And maybe some stuff was starting to go wrong. We can go on and talk about that. But certainly, I think starting out in September 94 on the road to England, we would have been very confident that we'd make it and that we could do something. And particularly with the games being next door, it would have been a fantastic chance for Irish fans to go in their tens and tens of thousands, you know.
Absolutely, yeah, definitely. And we can only think what it might have been if we had got there. It would have been absolutely fantastic. I think the country might have emptied for the summer of 1996. But I suppose it's interesting that you kind of talk about that. And are we kind of talking about a team perhaps that's in a little bit of transition then? Kind of experienced players have gone. Some newer ones came in, as we kind of talked about for USA 94, Phil Babb, these kind of players that had kind of come in and maybe needed that more time to kind of fit themselves into the Islands team, or where were we with that?
You see, well, I mean, the big three at the time that came in for USA 94 after qualifying were Phil Babb, Jason McAteer and Gary Kelly. But I suppose they all made an impact in America. So if anything, they were probably already considered part of the squad as such, you know. I don't think you could really consider it a time of that much transition. I mean, those three made a big difference, I suppose. There was a feeling maybe when we scraped over the line to get into USA 94 by losing to Spain and then drawing with Northern Ireland, that maybe from that perspective, things, I don't know, were a bit of a change. But, I mean, there was still the feeling there. I mean, if you like, we'd Alan Kelly, Paul McGrath was still around, Phil Babb, Dennis Irwin, key player, Steve Staunton was in his prime. John Sheridan was still there, Andy Towns and Niall Quinn, John Aldridge still banging in the goals. So we were in very good shape. And even if you look back at the squad that played in qualifying, it was still a top team. I mean, Ray Houghton was still a key part of the squad as well. So I don't think it was transition. I mean, Paddy Bonner was a loss, but I mean, Alan Kelly was an excellent deputy. Yeah, he's probably unfortunate not to have got more caps, you know, because, his father, Alan Kelly Jr., obviously from the 90s, his father was a legendary goalie back in the 60s, etc., back in the 50s even. That's where you're coming from. I think the squad appeared to be in good shape. And we would have been expected to do well in the campaign and to qualify.
And I suppose when you look at the start that we made in the group, we certainly looked like we were roaring ahead as we played Latvia away in our first game.
Yeah, so, I mean, Latvia was considered possibly or potentially to be a small bit of a banana skin. We had them in our group for the World Cup in 94. Now, we beat them home and away, but they managed to take points, if I remember correctly, off Denmark and Spain. So they certainly helped us in qualifying. So a little bit of concern going there, but it turned out to be a walk in the park, really. We were two up after half an hour. John Aldridge scored after 16 minutes. John Sheridan made it two before the half-hour mark. And Aldo got his second from the penalty spot with 15 minutes to go. Result never in doubt. We were in total control. It was a great start. I mean, just to say Northern Ireland had opened the group Maybe just talk about who we were drawn with. So we were top seeds. Maybe a little bit unfortunate to get Portugal as a very strong second seed. There were certainly weaker options there. We got Northern Ireland as a third seed, Austria as a fourth seed, who wouldn't have been considered to be that good at the time, Latvia as a fifth seed, and the Minnows that should have been the whipping boys for everyone were Liechtenstein. So Northern Ireland actually started the campaign back in April before the World Cup. They beat Liechtenstein 4-0, but I mean, that was considered a formality. So us starting, hammered Latvia 3-0, Austria were beating Liechtenstein, Portugal went to Belfast and got a late winner, which at the time was seen as a crucial goal. Jimmy Quinn had equalised for Northern Ireland in the second half, and Portugal got a winner 9 minutes from time, which was a big win for them.
Absolutely, yeah. So this kind of group that we're in at the moment, you kind of mentioned at the start that we were kind of expected perhaps to be at the very least, I suppose, there or thereabouts come the end of the end of the campaign. Just maybe talk a little bit about, I suppose, our near neighbours, Northern Ireland, because we'd played them before. We've had good recent results against them when we did. Is this still a Northern Ireland team that's trying to, I suppose, find its way again?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say they had come off a lot of the success in the 80s, being British champions twice in 80 and 84, going to the 82 and 86 World Cups, and particularly in 82 doing so well, beating the host Spain. They were probably in a bit of transition even when we met them in qualifying for 94. Of course, we also had them in our group for Italia, in the qualifying group for Italia 90. So in both cases, we'd beaten them at home comfortably and drawn in Windsor Park. A nil-all draw in 88 in a game we probably should have won. And that night we discussed about November 93 when Alan McLaughlin's crucial late equaliser sent us to the USA. So they were expected to be competitive, but I think at the time we felt we had a better team and we would have expected to finish ahead of them in qualifying. I mean, we could have got a lot worse as third seeds. I mean, they were the third seeds in the group. So, I mean, if you want to say we were a bit disappointed to get Portugal as second seeds. I mean, the likes of Belgium, Poland, Czech Republic were all, Croatia were all there in the third pot. So they would have been a lot more dangerous. Austria, as in the fourth pot, were probably one of the better teams, but weren't really expected to be that much of a threat at the time.
Yeah, and I suppose as well, we mentioned Austria because that's unfortunately going to come and haunt us in the end. But they lost 2-1 at home to Northern Ireland as well. So maybe that was a bit of a, I suppose, disguised as perhaps that Austria weren't that good as a team. And essentially, if a Northern Ireland team in transition can go away to them and beat them, that maybe this Austrian team wasn't that great.
Yeah, so that was the second match day, and it's probably worth mentioning as well. Well, a few days earlier, Portugal had gone to Latvia and won 3-1. But we actually got floodlights in Lansdowne Road for the first time for this campaign. So we had Liechtenstein at home, which I'm pretty sure was the first international, under the lights. So it was great for the fans as well. They didn't have to take time off work. To 10 games. I mean,
it seems, I know it's a modern day thing as well, but it seems like a crazy thing that it's only in 1994 that we're getting floodlights for our major international stadium that's hosting major international games, both in football and in rugby, it has to be said as well. So, yeah, so it's mad.
I mean, I might be, you catch me a little bit on my memory, but I'm pretty sure Talca Park got lights in 1953, if I remember correctly. Ballymount Park got lights in 1962, which I know is right because a Limerick man, Dick O'Connor, who only passed away there last week, Dick got the first goal under the Ballymount lights in 1962. So you fast forward now to 1994 before Lansdowne Road. install floodlights. And I mean, we were used to facts that games were on at 1 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the day to allow for the games to finish in daylight. So the lights coming in, it also was great for me because I actually moved to Dublin in the summer of 94. So instead of taking a day off work from Galway, I was able to go to the home games in the evening, finishing work at a normal time. But so that game against Liechtenstein, a full house as well, a sellout crowd. There was still huge demand for tickets. Lansdowne Road was all seater, so it was limited to approx 33,000. And that was with the temporary seats, which people may remember, behind both goals in the old Lansdowne Road. So we beat Liechtenstein 4-0, a couple of goals from Tommy Coyne, a couple from Niall Quinn. We were two up in 5 minutes. That was a formality. But people following the game in Vienna, Northern Ireland had a bit of a goalkeeping crisis, and they had to call on Paul Key. I think he might still have been playing in Ireland at the time, so he was a promising young goalkeeper. He was thrown in at the deep end in Vienna, and we will go on to talk about him again, but from this game, he was the hero of Vienna. He had the night of his life, and Northern Ireland beat Austria 2-1, which was a phenomenal win for them, and it basically was throwing the group wide open and saying, well, it's not very good for Austria, but Northern Ireland are definitely in the mix. Portugal, obviously, had started well, and we had started well. So even by October 94, it was starting to look like a three-horse race, but a couple of big games coming up, Austria going to Lisbon, and we had to go to Belfast to face Northern Ireland. So, but at the end of October 94, it was looking very much a three-horse race.
Yeah, and it seems like, even from the outset, it seems like it's a group that kind of, even though you can quote-unquote kind of weaker teams in there, but it seems like, bar Liechtenstein, there's a possibility of people taking points off each other, you know, regardless of where you think they are as a football team. So it makes it all the more kind of, I suppose, more interesting that there is a capability of teams taking points off each other everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fair to say Latvia away would be a little bit of a banana skin. It wouldn't be a foregone conclusion. Liechtenstein would have been a definite foregone conclusion. that we'll go on and talk about that as well. But yeah, Latvia were certainly capable of taking points off other teams. Austria, obviously. So that's the way we were.
Yeah, so it's a little bit tight, even though kind of we make a good start. And then in November 1994, we go away to Northern Ireland. Portugal beat Austria earlier in the day, and Latvia away to Liechtenstein. Only 1-0 win for Latvia, but a win nonetheless. But we go up to Windsor Park then, and we kind of take Northern Ireland apart, really, don't we?
Yeah, so Portugal, actually, I think that was played 3 days earlier. They seemed to play weekends, if I remember right at the time. So pretty sure it was a Wednesday night. We're going to Belfast. Probably one thing to put this in context, because we talked a lot about the November 93 game and so few fans went up and the tense situation at the time. By 1994, there was a ceasefire in place. There was peace in Northern Ireland. Everybody was a lot more optimistic. It was very different. There were, I think, up to 1,000 fans in Republic. So we didn't, if I remember rightly, we didn't have an allocation of tickets. We did a deal with Northern Ireland that there's no away fans, which probably didn't go down well with the Irish fans, but a lot of us were able to get tickets. It wasn't that difficult to get tickets. So there was anything up to 1,000 Irish fans going north of the border that night. It was a lot more supposedly relaxed. And we went out, and within 10 minutes, the game was virtually over. And Paul Key, who'd been the hero of Vienna, had kept his place and unfortunately had one of those nights a goalkeeper would want to forget. John Aldridge put us ahead in 6 minutes. Roy Keane made it 2 in the 11th minute. John Sheridan had knocked in a third before halftime. Andy Townsend made it four, and really it could have been anything. We were in total control, absolutely battered Northern Ireland that night. And at that stage in November 94, it looked like ourselves and Portugal could have booked our tickets to England.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Three wins from three, is what we started out with. It's interesting then, I suppose, what happens from here on out. And we'll talk about the possibilities or the reasons why, but I suppose the return fixture in Lansdowne Road for the Republic of Ireland against Northern Ireland is kind of where, is it fair to say it starts to go off the rails? You know, we've battered them up in Windsor. We probably expect to beat them down in Lansdowne Road for sure, but it doesn't quite work out that way.
Yeah, it's hard looking back with hindsight whether it was that then we went off the rails. I would nearly argue it was later after that. I mean, the game in Dublin, we didn't batter them, but we in the first half we were totally on top and just could not score. Now, they played a lot better. They defended incredibly well. Niall Quinn put us ahead in the second half, and it looked like it was job done. And I mean, Ian Dowie equalised with 18 minutes to go on what I can remember a very rare counter-attack. And even still, we had chances to win it. It was definitely a really, really frustrating night. That was actually played in daytime. I don't know, maybe it was a security thing or something like that. That was actually played in daylight now that I remember. I still think it was on a Wednesday or a midweek. But maybe for security reasons in Dublin, was played during the day. So it was a very frustrating afternoon. We really felt like it was 2 points dropped. But, I mean, at the time I thought we'd played pretty well. We just had trouble putting the ball in the net and putting them away. So I suppose maybe with hindsight you can argue that's where it started to go wrong. But what I would say is a month later, Portugal came to Dublin and we played incredibly well. And we beat Portugal 1-0. There's some dispute over who got the goal. Steve Staunton was definitely claiming it. The referee actually said he gave it to Steve Staunton as well, but a lot of places recorded it as an own goal by the Portuguese goalkeeper, Victor Baia. But, I mean, there had been some significant results in the group as well before that. Portugal had hammered Liechtenstein. Austria had hammered Latvia. Northern Ireland went to Latvia and won. Austria hammered Liechtenstein. So it's with that win over Portugal, I thought in April 95 had got us back on track. You know, had we beaten Northern Ireland and drawn with Portugal, we wouldn't have been saying anything was wrong. Okay, we dropped the points against Northern Ireland, we bounced back straight away and beat Portugal. And at that stage it looked like Portugal and ourselves were absolutely nailed on for England. We were in great shape at that stage.
Yeah, talk to us a little bit about that Republic of Ireland Portugal match as well, because it is a huge victory for us. It sets us up brilliantly within the group, particularly against, I suppose, the team that you would consider are the number one team in the group and the team to beat, and we've beaten them. Did it must have been a fantastic kind of victory to be around, because it probably changed maybe a little bit of our outlook towards maybe even winning the group.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose we were the top seeds. So, I mean, people could argue we were the team to beat in the group. But certainly the games against Portugal were seen as being pivotal games. They were a huge team, the likes of Luis Figo, etc., Rui Costa, the top, top players. They were really good to watch. São Pinto, João Pinto, etc. They came to Dublin. It was a full house, as always in those days. Brilliant atmosphere, played under the lights, and we played incredibly well. It was a really top performance, as good as anything we did under Jack Charlton. We deserved the goal. We deserved the lead. And I mean, it was only 1-0, but a great game played in a great atmosphere and a huge, huge 3 points, it was considered at the time. And it was felt we'd beaten the top team at home.
It's interesting what you said there, and I take my own kind of sense of accountability in here as well, which is, you know, a lot of people forget kind of, you mentioned we were top seeds in the group, etc. A lot of people forget how good we were, how well ranked in the world we were as well at the time. And so we make comparisons in the modern sense of, I suppose, where we are as a football team and where Portugal are now as a football team. And we kind of make this kind of presumption of, well, they were always great, weren't they? So, you know, when we look back on things and we go, oh, geez, we beat Portugal, blah, blah, blah. But it's also that kind of sense of understanding that actually, in our own right, we were a very, very good team, ranked very highly in the world, and people considered us a real threat.
Yeah, I mean, what I would definitely say is Portugal would have been coming to Dublin hoping for a point. I mean, really? They would have been, before that game, they would have been absolutely delighted with a point. With all due respects, when they come here in November, I don't think they're going to be coming to play for a point and stuff.
They might be disappointed if they don't get three.
Well, I mean... yeah, I should also go back to February 95 and talk about the friendly against England, which was the only friendly in this campaign. So we arranged this glamour friendly under the Lansdowne lights. England were back in town. We had played them, of course, in the qualifying for Euro 92. Huge demand, but it's a night that's gone down in infamy for probably obviously a poor decision to put the English fans in the top corner of the West End, where they put the English fans in the upper tier of the West End, where it at the side of the old South Terrace, and they were ripping out the old wooden seats, throwing them down on Irish fans below. There was fights. The guards got involved. There was an absolute riot. And we were winning 1-0 at the time, and the game was stopped midway through the first half. And it basically was called off. It was abandoned. Mm. It was a night of shame for the English fans, and probably a night that's going to go down, not from a football terms, but from the riots that ensued. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned earlier as well, when we played Northern Ireland, there was a much more comfortable atmosphere, a feeling maybe that we were kind of moving forward with those kind of nights, with those kind of attitudes and those kind of things. And then it comes straight back in on top of us again. I suppose you call it the old enemy, etc. And all of a sudden we're back to talking about English hooligans, you know, Irish fans getting hurt, you know, and all of those kind of different things, and it seemed to just kind of go, are we back here again?
Yeah, no, I mean, I suppose I should say that, I mean, there were Irish fans in the home end at Windsor Park. Some had to leave after the second goal. They celebrated in the home end, and there was quite some angry Northern Ireland fans around, and there was a bit of abuse shouted. So even though there was a ceasefire and people weren't killing each other, it doesn't mean that necessarily
the peace and light go away.
Yeah, so I mean, and particularly, I mean, we absolutely battered them on the pitch. So there was quite a lot of fans getting angry in the stands, particularly if Republic of Ireland fans were celebrating goals. So there were, I mean, I remember a few harsh words being exchanged, and some fans actually in the first half, Republic of Ireland fans decided to leave. I don't think any were thrown out, but a couple of guys, I think, just decided, maybe they were a bit taken aback by the vitriol or whatever. So it wasn't all sweetness and light, let's say. The England game, there was still a major hooligan issue with the England fans at that point. And certainly there were security failures. Given the trouble the fans were causing to put them in that section of the West upper stand where they could rip out the wooden seats for ammunition, for want of a better word. There wasn't sufficient police, stewarding, etc. on duty. And another thing that happened was England returned 1,000 tickets on the day of the match, and they were sold out of Merrion Square to Irish fans. And actually, my own father ended up in the middle of the England fans. So for myself, I was very, very concerned. I was over in the East Stand, so I was watching it unfold. But my cousin, my dad was driving up, and we had our tickets sorted well in advance. But my cousin was asking my brother, is there any chance of a lift? Can we get an extra ticket? My dad says, yeah, I'll get a ticket. Come on, sit into the car. And he went into Merrion Square and bought one of the 1,000 tickets that was so returned by the FA. So you had 1,000 Irish fans in the middle of, I can't remember, there must have been 2,000, 3,000, 4,000. I can't remember actually how many English fans were there that night. But you had Irish fans in the middle of the English fans. Now, in my dad's case, as soon as he saw the trouble, he just ran. He got out, and we had a meeting point afterwards, and he was the first one there. But I was looking at this from the East Stand and being very concerned, because I knew my dad was in the middle of it. Mm. Or at least I thought he did, but at the first sign of trouble, he'd actually left.
Wise man.
Which was a very, 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 very wise man. I'd probably want to stay around, unfortunately. So.
It sounds like the even if you want to consider back then or whatever, but it sounds like the most bizarre things to even let Irish fans be in amongst an away kind of section like that. Particularly, I suppose, with the name that had come with English football fans, both at home and away as well. So, I suppose looking at that night as well, it was the frustrating thing. I suppose from our point of view is we were in the lead and we were playing quite well. We were playing good football, and now it's like it never happened result wise.
Yeah, I mean, we probably would have beaten them. I think, well, you can never argue any differently, but certainly in my book, I think we would have beaten them. We were 1-0 up. We were the better team. It was certainly very naive of the FAI to sell those tickets. They actually initially denied it on the Joe Duffy show the following day. And Joe Duffy, now my dad didn't call in, but he was inundated with callers saying, I walked into Merrion Square. I was there at 10 o'clock in the morning. I bought a ticket and it was in the English section. And people, caller after caller, and eventually they admitted it did happen. I don't know. I mean, maybe it was the thought of losing the revenue from 1,000 tickets, but the FBI would have been quite wealthy at the time. There was a lot of money there from USA 94, etc. So it was certainly, look, it was a very naive thing to do. The level of security and policing for the England fans in 95 was nothing like the levels they would have experienced on the continent, etc., or even for games in England. I mean, I went to football matches in England at the time, and even club games, the level of policing would be levels above what would be in Lansdowne Road. Now, the reality is, in Lansdowne Road, if Portugal, even Northern Ireland, were coming to town, there was no need for that levels of police. You know, there was no trouble. Fans were well behaved. You could go in and support Portugal, no problem, in Lansdowne Road, and the Irish fans got on fine with them. But England in those days, there was a hooligan element that were basically there just to cause trouble. And one of the ones that actually struck me, because I used to work in IT and computer industry, one of the English fans arrested, his screensaver back in work, he was working in an IT company in the UK, and it had gone to fight for Queen and Country. And I mean, it's his employer actually released that, because he was arrested in Dublin, you know. Wow. So you know, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, and it's such a strange thing to, I mean, it's a whole podcast in its own, essentially talking about hooligans. But I mean, even Like I happened to be in London a couple of years ago when I said I'd get tickets for a match if there was any around, and I ended up in West Ham, go to a West Ham game, and even there, you know, there's police everywhere. There's usually a couple of police on horses and stuff like that. Maybe not near around the ground, but in the estates around the ground, and there's always police somewhere around, and they take it very seriously, in the UK, and that's the reason why.
Yeah, I mean, you just, even to this day, you don't, if you go on the wrong end, you have to keep your mouth shut. Mm. You have to be really careful. And I mean, I'm not just talking about in the Premier League, I'm talking about down the leagues. I remember going to Southend and Reading in the late 1980s, and to be honest, I was neutral, but the person that was with me was a passionate Reading fan. We ended up getting 2 free tickets for the main stand with the home fans, and it got really, really, really ugly. You know, it's when Reading equalised, and I mean, I didn't care. So it's and it wasn't, this was the end of season. It wasn't even an important match, but you don't go on the wrong end. I mean,
it's kind of a given now. If you go to a match and you end up in the home end and you start giving it all that, you know, you're, something's going to happen. Do you know? I mean, don't be daft, basically. But we have digressed, I say, from that match. But it is a match that lives, not famously, but infamy. It's an infamous match in Irish football.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the game being abandoned, I mean, it's 30 years ago now, but people still talk about it. And thankfully, England have come back to Dublin since with no issues. But it was a night of infamy.
Absolutely, yeah. We've come off the back of a week of the talk about Armenia and the result of that match, etc., at the time that we record this. But I suppose this next result probably has to go down in infamy as well for Irish football, as we try to get to Euro 96. We're away at Liechtenstein.
Yeah, no, I suppose we have to put the whole week in context. I'm pretty sure this was a Saturday game, if I remember rightly. Season was over. We're going to Liechtenstein. It was pretty much a formality, and we'd Austria at home a week later, which we would have been expected to win as well. And that would have been pretty much had set us up. I think we'd almost have been over the line at that point if we'd got the 2 wins. Went to Liechtenstein. Now, we can talk. I mean, a lot of the disappointment in Armenia was the performance and everything, not just the result. This was really, I think, a freak result, an absolute freak. We had so many chances. The keeper of the day of his life, there was shots taken off the line. We were hitting the woodwork. And for some incredible reason, they managed to hold out for 90 minutes of an absolute battering. And somehow it stayed 0-0. But it was a huge, huge disappointment. A disastrous result, but also a total shock. But I don't know what it set in chain, but certainly that result could certainly be seen as the start of the decline. And what went on in the following, in the week that followed, was certainly another one that will go down in infamy with Irish football. Yeah, so
absolutely, yeah. So it's a 0-0. We may have been unlucky, but it's still an embarrassing 0-0 away to Liechtenstein. And then we have a chance to make it right against Austria at home a week later. And I suppose it's interesting because we did take the lead as well in that match. So
okay, well, there's a whole week of this, and there's a lot of other stuff went on that week. So maybe we'll keep this in context. We certainly had no luck against Liechtenstein, but you shouldn't need luck to beat them. So the squad were in Limerick for the week between coming back on the Sunday from Liechtenstein until the Austria game was the following Sunday. So I think maybe the Friday they went back up to Dublin. In the middle of that week, Latvia were coming to Belfast to play Northern Ireland on the Wednesday night, and Jack left the squad on the Tuesday and didn't return to Limerick until the Thursday. And I'm only going by rumours because I was living in Dublin at the time, but there were certainly stories from everybody in Limerick that the players and the squad, and Limerick was a very small place in those days, were out day and night. Once Jack was gone, they were out, let's say, enjoying themselves for those few days, which certainly didn't help the preparation for Austria on the Sunday.
Yeah. And this is at a time, by the way, and I've read different kind of books and all that kind of stuff. This is at a time when perhaps nutritional science, shall we say, was not deemed one of the most important things as a professional footballer.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, players in those days would have had a couple of pints after a game. But certainly it would have been, and I mean, if you believe even a fraction of the stories, there are levels and there are degrees to which you do it. And I probably don't want to say any more than that.
They overdid it is basically what you're saying, is it?
Yeah, I think it was certainly overdone when once the cat was away, as in Jack.
The mice will play.
They certainly played, and I mean, Latvia winning in Belfast was a nice boost for us, but if Jack had stayed in Limerick, who knows what might have happened. Now, Jack has to shoulder some of the blame as well, because Jack then had just done a sponsorship deal with the Harry Ramsden's Fish and Chip Shop, and there was a thing called the Harry Ramsden's Challenge, and if you could eat this massive fish and this massive plate of chips, I think you got a free dessert. So Jack brought the squad as a promotional thing, I think the day before the Austria match, out to Harry Ramsden on the Nace Road. It might have been the Friday coming back from Limerick or the Saturday. I can't recall which day, but I think it was the Saturday just before the match. And I think it was Gary Kelly, forgive me if I got this one wrong, completed and succeeded in the Harry Ramsden's challenge. And it certainly, you talk about nutritional science. I'm by no means an expert in nutritional science,
nor
but
me.
Even with my very, very, very basic knowledge, I would imagine that Harry Ramsden's fish and chips is not a good match day meal for match day minus one. So it probably was a whole sign of the week of preparation not going very well.
Mm. I suppose as well, when you look at it too, their last result in this group had been against Liechtenstein themselves, and they'd pounded them 7-0. Portugal had put 8 past Liechtenstein. So there were kind of warning signs that this was an Austrian team that could put it together if you weren't prepared.
There were and there weren't. I mean, they weren't expected to. They probably needed to beat us twice to have any chance in the group. And at that stage, it looked, I mean, putting 7 or 8 past Liechtenstein wasn't that big a deal, I suppose, back in those days, you know.
Well, we hadn't done it in one of the matches.
Well, we'd put 4 past them, but we'd the game put to bed in the first few minutes. Goal difference didn't matter in those days. It was the head-to-head. So in a lot of cases, I think our 4-0 win was, the game was done and dusted after a few minutes and players were resting and watching themselves, etc. So obviously the 0-0 draw was a total disaster, but it wasn't, I wouldn't have read too much into an 8-0 or a 7-0 win. Portugal got 8 and 7, I suppose, which shows they absolutely blew them away. But certainly Austria were coming to Dublin and we would have been hot favourites to beat them at the time. And even for with the lack of proper preparation, it was still it was an absolute shock to the system.
So tell us about this game. We're at home to Austria. by the sounds of it, we are fully expected to win this game, regardless of what you think Austria are or are not. What happens in the game? And as I mentioned before, we did take the lead, but that seemed to evaporate pretty quickly.
Yeah, it's a really strange game, and I mean, I actually remember it very well. We battered them. We absolutely battered them. And it looked like it was going to be one of those days when we just couldn't score. And I think if we hadn't scored, it might have gone on like the Liechtenstein game and finished 0-0, and we'd have been saying, for God's sake, how did we not win that? Because following on from Liechtenstein, we had 64 minutes of pounding on the door. Their keeper had a superb game. I don't think they had a shot on goal. We were in total control. It looked like we were never going to score. And then Ray Houghton makes the breakthrough into the south terrace, and we go 1-0 up in the 65th minute, and we're thinking, wow, yes, done, job done. And we should go on and win the game now. And the Liechtenstein result would have been put behind us at that stage. And we just fell apart. I mean, they scored three goals. So the lead lasted 4 minutes, and Tony Polster equalised, and they went on to score three goals in 9 minutes. Polster got a second, and in between, that it was Ogris got a goal for them as well. And we just seemed to be all over the place at the back, and they got those three goals in 9 minutes, and they beat us 3-1.
I wonder, was it a case of, you know, that I suppose our back four just hadn't been under that much pressure for most of the game, and all of a sudden Austria just went, right, we're 1-0 down, kitchen sink, we can't either way, we're still losing, so you might as well just go for it. And all of a sudden nobody was prepared for Austria to come out and play some football, and it all fell apart.
Yeah, and you have to question that the preparation during the week, that maybe for the last 20 minutes the fitness wasn't what it should have been. It was the end of the season as well, so players may have been tired after a long season, but definitely the preparation that week was not right. And I think that took its toll. And that was a disastrous home defeat.
Yeah, and I suppose it was perhaps made stranger by the next time that Austria played. They played away to Latvia and lost 3-2. So it kind of raised, I suppose, more questions as to where that performance from Ireland came in. And then we had to go away to Austria for our next game. And it was another disaster.
Yeah, it was another disaster. And I mean, I suppose 3 days earlier, Northern Ireland had gone to Porto and drawn 1-1 with Portugal, which was an incredible result. And particularly as they'd come off a home defeat by Latvia. And that kind of put them back in the mix again as well. We went away to Austria. We were going there hoping for a win, and at least expecting to get at least a draw and to make up for what happened. It went wrong at the start. Peter Stoger put them 1-0 up after 3 minutes, but we actually had a lot of the play for the rest of the first half, and we should have equalised. If you look back at both games against Austria, we dominated the games, but they played us very well in the break. They went 2-0 just after the hour. Again, we came right back at them. Paul McGrath got a goal back. And then with 15 minutes to go, we thought, yeah, we can still get a point out of this. But unfortunately, Peter Stoger, he completed his hat-trick a couple of minutes after Paul McGrath's goal. And that was it. We were done. And beaten home and away by Austria. And at that point, qualification was... Well, it wasn't quite out of our hands because we still had to go to Lisbon. But it was suddenly looking very, very bleak.
It was an interesting kind of similarity in the two games with Austria. We scored and they scored like within 5 minutes afterwards. So So between the two games, it was essentially we scored and then minutes later they scored. And that was really kind of what really outdid us.
Yeah.
And I mean, they were just, to lose home and away to them at that stage was just a huge blow and I mean, a real shock for the system.
So things not looking so good when Latvia come to town in October 1995. 33,500 at Lansdowne Road to see us finally win a game for the first time in, four games?
Yeah, and it was a very nervy one again. There were definitely signs things had come off the rails at that point. I mean, Austria were playing Portugal and Vienna at the same time, which was a crucial game, and that actually ended in the result we wanted, which was a draw. We took a long time to break Latvia down. It took us an hour. John Aldridge finally got a penalty as the breakthrough. He scored again a couple of minutes later, and you kind of felt it was job done. But they got a goal back with about 12 minutes to go, and it was a very, very nervy, edgy last 12 minutes. It was not a good performance. We were very relieved to hear the final whistle. And although it was a crucial win, it was one walking out of Lansdowne Road, you're feeling things are still not right. There are issues, but...
It sounds like a team that's under, because of the previous results that have happened, it sounds like a team that's now under a huge amount of pressure to start delivering and to start winning games. When we play Latvia, it's like, oh my God, we absolutely, bar nothing, we have to win this game. And that's that kind of pressure coming down now from everything that's happened before.
And the pressure was definitely on to beat Latvia. It was a huge game, a huge win. But the concerns were there. The performance was still well below what had been we'd seen up to April 95. It was still even a lot of pressure after the game. There was certainly a feeling at that stage, even by October, that maybe the end had come with the good days, etc. That
really was there already talk even before the campaign had finished that perhaps this kind of era had kind of petered out?
Yeah, there was. I mean, there was quite a bit of negativity around, even though, I mean, we were still going to Portugal needing a win to top the group.
Mm.
So we could have, with the way all the results had happened, we were going to Portugal on 17 points. And if I remember, Austria were on 16, Northern Ireland were on 14, Portugal were on 20. But because of the head-to-head records, if we won in Lisbon, we were through, Portugal were through, and we had topped the group.
Mm.
So, but I think even coming out of the Latvia game and in the run-up to the Portugal game, the atmosphere was very different. And I don't think too many people expected us to go to Lisbon and win, which... If you'd asked us back in March or April, okay, I mean, realistically, you're going away to Lisbon, you'd be absolutely delighted with a point. But we would have expected to pick up a point there, you know.
Mm.
We certainly wouldn't have been going there expecting to lose. And certainly winning there would not have been out of the question in April 95. But coming into October, November 95... and the performances, Liechtenstein, Austria twice, and Latvia at home, there had been, in reality, four poor performances, and Lisbon was a daunting task.
And it turned out to be a daunting task, because I suppose for a while there, we held out for 60-odd minutes, but, I mean, does it just compound the view then that this team is... perhaps not where we thought it was?
Yeah, I mean, one thing to put in perspective, it absolutely poured out of the heavens that night. I mean, everyone got absolutely soaked. My memory is it rained nonstop. Now, maybe you can look back and say the forecast had stopped for a while, but my memory is that evening before it started maybe an hour or so before the game, I could be a little bit off in my timings there, it started pouring up, bucketing out of the heavens. And my memory is it was still raining after the game, and it rained nonstop. It absolutely bucketed down. It was a backs-to-the-wall performance. So we did hold out for an hour, But I don't remember any real chances. And I suppose we were hoping keep it nil-nil, maybe nick a goal somewhere. Also at that stage, the best runners up was gone at that stage, but the playoff was still in play if Northern Ireland beat Austria, or if we got a point, a draw for Northern Ireland would also have done. So, but Rui Costa scored on the hour mark, and that was it. That was game over. They got a couple more, but they tore us apart. They beat us 3-0. It was...
That goal kind of opens up the floodgates, really, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there was no coming back once they took the lead. I mean, we were hanging on, hoping for 0-0, and I suppose the dream of nicking a goal in the last 10 minutes or something. But we were well outplayed. The better team won. And 3-0 did not flatter Portugal. And I mean, us holding out for the hour was probably the surprising part.
So where to here? So explain to us, I suppose, the rankings and how they influence getting into a playoff or not. So explain that one to us again.
So it was a strange one. I mean, normally UEFA used to count out the bottom team, but for this, they counted out the bottom two teams. And well, first of all, that night, and it was actually hard to get details because mobile phones were not that common at that stage, even still. But Northern Ireland beat Austria 5-3 to put us into the playoff. And there was different, in the old days, there was different people at different stories. I don't know whether some of them were deliberately spreading false rumors, but certainly there were stories there that Austria had won and we were out. And then other people were saying, obviously given the correct score as well. And some people were saying it was a draw. So there was all sorts of stories after the game. I think it was a few minutes after the game, we saw some FAI official or someone outside that confirmed that someone you could absolutely trust. And so that got us the runners-up spot. So we finished level with Northern Ireland at 17 points, a point ahead of Austria. We had Northern Ireland on the head-to-head, whereas obviously Austria, if they'd got the draw, would have had us on the head-to-head. So the way it worked was the eight group winners had qualified, which is Portugal from our group. The six best runners up, based on the results against teams 1-4 in the group. So our draw in Liechtenstein didn't matter from this point of view, but our two wins against Latvia were also chalked off. And we ended up as being the bottom runner-up. Now, there had been a chance that Turkey would have been the other runner-up, but Netherlands, they got a good win and a couple of draws late on, and the Netherlands dropped points. So we ended up playing the Dutch. So the worst two runners up were the Dutch and ourselves. And that set up a playoff at Anfield a month later for a place in Euro 96.
Yeah, and it's kind of strange now that to think that it's a once-off, almost like a cup final kind of thing, and not a home and away goals type of thing that we've come to kind of get used to in the modern sense of the game that we know now. Is there any specific reason why there was just a one-off playoff? Was that just the way it was designed, winner takes all?
Yeah, so that was the way it was designed at the time. So the playoffs weren't that common at that stage. I mean, there were playoffs if you go back to the 60s, and we had a famous playoff with Spain for a place in the 66 World Cup. But that's because we had finished level in the group with a win each. And that was ended up, we talked about it before, it was played in Paris. And Spain beat us 1-0 to qualify. But in this case, the playoff was always designed to be held in England because they were the hosts of Euro 96, as a trial run. So one match was not seen as a surprise. It was only the following campaign that FIFA and UEFA started to introduce these home and away playoffs for at the end of the group stage. So this was kind of a one-off game. And I mean, playing at Anfield, in many ways, it was like a home game.
Yeah, it would be for Irish fans, really, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, we were given the cop end. We also had a lot of tickets down the side. I mean, it was certainly an incredible atmosphere, a full house. There was quite a big Dutch travelling support, but they were certainly dwarfed by the Irish support at the time. Mm. And
I mean, the Dutch aren't far away either. They're a ferry or a plane journey away, you know, an hour plane journey away anyway, so.
Yeah, so, but they, in those days, they wouldn't have traveled in the same numbers that they do today. And certainly they wouldn't have traveled in the numbers that we traveled in those days.
So talk to us about the game at Anfield. How did we play? Are we outclassed, outplayed, or are we in it for a while, or what?
We're in it for a while, but I think if you go back to July 94, we probably expected to beat the Dutch. I don't think too many people expected us to win in December. Patrick Kluivert put him ahead in the first half. We did have a bit of a go. We had chances to equalise, but they were the better side, and he got the second goal late in the game to finish us off. I mean, and it was certainly a feeling that was the end. You know, the fans, I mean, we stayed on long after the game. Jack came out, and I think everyone knew at that stage, I think Jack was gone. That was his. Now, I think it subsequently said he was pushed by the FAI.
I mean, there was a sense, because I remember, you know, obviously watching back and the pictures and stuff like that. He certainly seems like a manager that knows, right, I'm kind of done now. He's out with the flag, etc. And he's kind of essentially saying goodbye. So he kind of knew that this was the last of it. It's interesting that you kind of say that he was perhaps pushed. Is that something that we kind of suspect happened, or was there talk that the FAI kind of said, look, it's time to start moving on with something new?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, first of all, Jack was an absolute legend. And I mean, he brought us the best days we've 100%. Ever had in Irish football. But certainly looking back at the time, there was a feeling, let's say, from June on, that things had started to go wrong. And there probably was a feeling Jack was going to go himself. And I suppose I didn't think at the time he had been pushed, but it was just a feeling that he was going to go. But I know he did say himself afterwards he felt he wasn't wanted any longer, and the feeling was that his time was up. And now, who knows what would have happened if he'd stayed on. But there was a feeling as well, maybe if you go on to the next campaign, there was going to be more changing of the guard. Maybe more players are going to retire, etc. I mean, the dream for Jack would have been to take us to England 30 years after he won the World Cup as a player and possibly compete to win a major international tournament as a manager. But that wasn't to be. And even if he'd got the chance to say goodbye at a major tournament, it would have been very special.
So it's the end of the Charlton era, a decade of what you can only just be described as the golden period of Irish football. When we, I suppose it's difficult to kind of, I suppose, go and talk about the impact of Jack Charlton on Irish international football. But I suppose as somebody who's been there such a long time and who lived all those wonderful moments, you were in those kind of those fantastic days in all the kind of great results that we had in different stadiums around the world. How, I mean, you are a football historian, but you're also a fan. So how do you put into words the kind of living through that kind of era and being around at that time and what Jack brought?
I mean, they were, but unquestionably, the golden age, as you said, the best days to be involved in Irish football and be there as a fan. I mean, when Jack took over, I mean, believe it or not, football was still the most played sport in the country, but our national football team was not really in the public consciousness. We were getting good crowds, maybe going to games, but for a lot of the population, the matches just passed them by. Within a couple of years, every man, woman and child was watching the games, knew the players, and the games just meant so much. Everybody wanted to be there. the tickets were the hottest tickets. You just couldn't get them. The FAI had a block booking waiting list that was huge, and just it wasn't moving. And I mean, the people who had block bookings were just so happy to have them, and they were, you were never going to give them up. They were great days as fans. It was great to be in the stadiums around the world and see so many performances, so many fantastic results. Jack really put us, well, he put football on the map in this country, but he also put Ireland on the map, on the global map, on the global stage in world football. And I mean, I said everybody in Ireland knew about us. I mean, we were well respected throughout the football world. He brought us the sixth in the world in 94. We beat, I mean, was it three consecutive away games? We beat the Dutch, the Germans, and then, well, Italy was in neutral, I suppose, but we beat Italy as well. You know, and it's that kind of performances, that kind of results. We got to the quarterfinal of a World Cup. We were 7 minutes away from the semi-finals of a Euros. I still maintain if we qualified for Euro 92, we could well have won that tournament. That was, if anything, that was the peak of Jack's teams, but it just, we couldn't get over the line and get to Sweden. But we were so strong at that stage. There were such fantastic days for fans, for players, for everything. I mean, those players will remain as heroes, as legends, forever.
Mm. It's interesting. I think before we started this podcast, I probably wouldn't have done a huge amount of research into it and looked into it and read about it and stuff like that. Obviously, I would have seen, you know, the videos and all that kind of stuff. But I think I kind of have reflected perhaps on my own opinion about Jack Charlton, where I grew up on the notion perhaps that we didn't play football, that we parked the bus and you know we got wins kind of through grit, and you know, we didn't really play good football. And yet when you've done research and you watch games and you've talked to players, and talked to, obviously in our previous podcast, I sat down with Tony Galvin, who was obviously very much part of Jack Charlton's plans, played in all his games at Euro 88, and I asked him about it, and he kind of said, look, you know, Jack had a very specific game plan. Do you know what I mean? He wanted you to play football, just not anywhere near your box. Do you know what I mean? So, like, it wasn't that he was saying to us, look, lump the ball forward, don't play football. Do you know what I mean? That he didn't want you to do that. He wanted you to do it in specific places, the right places, the final third. That's where he wanted you to play football. And when you didn't have the ball, yeah, you put them under pressure. Why would you let them sit around with the ball and pass you to death? Do you know what I mean? Get in their face. So I think perhaps I've reflected perhaps on my own predispositions on what I thought Jack Charlton was as a manager too. And that, you know, he got the best out of players because he made what they did on the pitch very definitive. You know, there was no kind of big kind of, like, you know, ticky-tacky football. It was simple. This was your job. This is what you had to do. This is what you do when you have the ball. This is what you do when you don't. And that's it. And I think you're absolutely right. Yes, we can all see it was a golden period, but it was just, we played football. We did play football. We did play some fantastic football, and we scored some fantastic goals under Jack Charlton with some great players.
And I mean, I suppose there were arguments going on at that time as well. But to put a couple of things into context and some of the things he did, which did revolutionize the game a bit. Back in those days, and even before that, the term a sweeper was quite common. I mean, Franz Beckenbauer, well, the libero, it was more the fancy European term, but a sweeper in England or British football. And you play the sweeper behind the back four to cut out any issues. Jack inverted that and played Paul McGrath in front of the back four as a modern day holding midfielder. And he more or less, I think, invented that role. And it certainly made a difference. Now, Paul himself will have said that with Kevin Moran and Mick McCarthy behind him, they were a rock as well and could tell him what to do. But that made us very hard to beat. And Jack had a system like that. As you said, he was not going to put the ball at risk. He wasn't going to be playing out from the back. I mean, the goalkeeper could pick up a back pass and all in those days as well. So the days of Pep Guardiola tiki-tacky football was not, but he didn't put the ball at risk. Now, you talked about put them under pressure. In modern terms, you talk about that as pressing.
Yeah.
And we had
Gegenpressing the front and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, right? Yeah, exactly. I mean, Jurgen Klopp is a genius because of all this Gegenpressing. What I mean,
Jack was doing it 30 years ago.
I mean, effectively, yes. I mean, that's what we were doing. We were the likes of John Aldridge in particular. John had run his legs off but the strikers, their job was to close down the opposition fullback and centre half, put them under pressure, win the ball high up the pitch, press them. And that's where we got goals. Now, it is true to say we weren't great to watch. And I mean, Liam Brady can be used as an example, who in some ways was pushed aside by Jack after 1988. But I mean, Liam Brady had a fantastic qualification campaign from 86, 87. Unfortunately, he got sent off against Bulgaria and he would have missed the first two games, and he also got injured. Now, there's a lot of debate about Liam Brady and about Italia 90 and should he have been starting, etc. Jack felt he didn't have the legs. Liam was one of those players with the skill, pick out a pass, etc., but Jack felt he didn't have the legs for his midfield role. I suppose it's fair to say the Liam Brady of 89-90 at West Ham, etc., was not the player of the earlier 80s that had gone, well, the Arsenal of the late 70s, 1980, went to Juventus, yeah, Inter, Sampdoria, etc. So it is the passage of time. Jack didn't treat him very well against Germany, taking him off in the first half. But look, we didn't really have a midfielder spraying passes around the place, but we were a very, very difficult team to beat. We were very well organized. Everybody knew their jobs. Look, there were certainly some bad games in that period. Some of the football was a bit turgid, but there was also, we had high quality players playing at the best of their ability. You talked about the likes of Paul McGrath, Ronnie Whelan, etc. I mean, they were quality players and they made a huge impact.
I suppose obviously his famous phrase, put them under pressure, is this thing that puts him in our minds. But I suppose another way of putting it would be, go out and basically make it very, very difficult for them to beat us. And that is essentially was his mentality, wasn't it? It was just make sure that you're difficult to beat and everything else will come from that. You'll get your chances. You know, we've got good players. We can get goals, but be very, very difficult to beat. And that is where I suppose it all kind of spiraled out from.
Yeah, if you want to use the expression, don't beat yourselves. You know, I mean, we didn't go out and throw games away, which, I mean, you often see in football today. I mean, people giving away, don't want to use too many examples, but giving away really, really bad goals and gifting goals to the opposition. I mean, generally, maybe you can maybe prove me wrong with one or two examples, but generally we didn't do that. We were tough to beat. We were tough to break down. Every game starts at 0-0, and if you make sure it doesn't get any worse than that, you've always got a very good chance of winning the game, you know. And certainly, you never had it easy against the Jack Charlton side. We were never a soft touch. Now, maybe what I've talked about from the June on 95, so maybe there were signs there, and there were a number of goals, I suppose, given away, those six goals against Austria, etc., that maybe things had gone off the rails a bit. But in general, in the Charlton era, we were a very difficult side to beat, and we could compete with the best in the world. And if anything, there can be regrets in saying, well, I wonder, could we have actually won a tournament?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting when I was doing research for this episode, there's a quote from him, and I think it came from his book about, he was obviously talking about that qualifying campaign, the Euro 96 one, and he said, "In my heart of hearts, I knew I wrung as much as I could out of the squad I got. Some of my older players had given me all that they had to give." So I think it sounds like both he knew he had come to the end of the road, but he also knew that some of those players in the squad had come to the end of the road as well. And perhaps that's a good time to say, you know, I've done my bit. Maybe it's time for somebody else to take the reins.
Yeah, I think that's probably a fair comment. I suppose that was the feeling at the Dutch game, that maybe we knew he was saying goodbye and that his time has come. I suppose hearing him talk afterwards that he kind of felt he was a bit pushed aside was maybe a little bit disappointing. That I think if he had wanted to stay on, maybe, but who knows, maybe a lot of players, managers, etc., can stay on too long at clubs, at national teams, and maybe tarnish their reputation.
Yeah,
and you know, and I mean that has its own impact as well. You know, that players that stay on too long, and you can have fans, etc., complaining in those situations as well.
Yeah, I wonder just on what you're saying there, could he be accused maybe of being too loyal to maybe some of the players, that maybe he should have said, look, we might need some fresher legs here to come in and start making way, or was it a simple case of he loved players who he knew could do a job for him, and that was that?
Yeah, I suppose if you look at the players, I mean, a lot of them were still going. I mean, Mick still ended up using a lot of those players. I mean, the likes of Dennis Irwin was still around for quite a few years after that. Steve Staunton went to the 2002 World Cup and was still a key performer for many years. Okay, Andy Townsend, John Sheridan, they were probably reaching the end of their days. I think they did still play under Mick. Niall Quinn made a difference. John Aldridge was...
They had a lot of injuries, though, as well. Andy Townsend got very injury-prone towards the end of his career.
Yeah, and John Aldridge, I mean, he was still there under Mick, but I think the end of his days were coming. I mean, Roy Keane actually, if I remember correctly, missed a lot of that campaign through injury. He certainly missed the week between Liechtenstein and Austria. And he missed a number of games. I'd have to look back exactly on the stats, but he would have been a big loss at that stage as well. Obviously, he stayed around for many years after that and made a huge impact. I mean, Alan Kelly was a fine keeper. Shea Given was to take over. But Alan is probably unfortunate that he didn't get even more caps, or he was only first choice for a short period. So... I don't know whether there was too many players that he could have moved on. Were there any obvious players? I mean, it did turn out the likes of Damien Duff, Robbie Keane and all them were to come later than that, but they weren't on the radar. They would have been very, very young at that stage, so they wouldn't have been on Jack's radar at all. So... I don't know if the players were exactly knocking on the door to push some of these out of the squad.
And in fairness, the way we started the group, you wouldn't have assessed that it would end the way that it did end. So perhaps he knew the team and he knew his players. So, I mean, it's fair to say that, you know, the performances perhaps in some of the matches just weren't there either.
Yeah, I think that's probably more to it than anything else, because if you go right up to April 95, we were top of the group. We'd only dropped 2 points. We'd beaten Portugal at home. Mm. We were in fantastic shape. And, I mean, some of those players like Ray Houghton were still making a big impact under Mick, scoring crucial goals in playoffs, etc., a couple of years after that. So I don't... I suppose it's very easy with hindsight to go back and say things, but yeah. I think that week in June, certainly there were a lot of mistakes made. I mean, the drinking culture in football in general, in British football, for want of a better word, was much more established then. But things definitely got out of hand that week in Limerick. The Harry Ramsden's challenge, I mean, it can't have been a good preparation. And then, obviously, everything going wrong, having taken the lead against Austria, probably a hangover from the draw with Liechtenstein as well. I mean, it was just...
Yeah,
I suppose that was the beginning of the end. You know?
So, Limerick ruined our chances of getting to Euro 96, is that what you're saying?
Well, only if you believe the rumours, I suppose. You know.
So that's the end of Jack Charlton. He goes off for fishing in the sun and pints of Guinness, etc. As well. And so then we have a new era that comes after that, but we'll talk about that in our next podcast. Absolutely fantastic stuff. Really great to talk about that. And I talk about the impact, the serious and well-founded impact that Jack Charlton had on Irish football as well, in that era, the golden era of Irish football. As ever, Gary, thanks for talking to us and sharing not just your historical insights, but your insights as a fan as well in that amazing period too.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Well, that's it for this week's show. Share the show on your social media channels to let more people find out about the history and heritage of Irish football. Turn on your notifications on whatever podcast platform you use so that you can get notified straight away when a new episode drops. And remember, support your local League of Ireland and Northern Ireland Football League clubs. It's our heritage, it's our game. Bye for now.